Good morning, everyone, and welcome back to our weekly didactic podcast reviewing the primary care didactics for the Virginia Mason Internal Medicine Residency Program. I'm Aldhani Mohanachandran, one of the core faculty, and today I am joined by my wonderful colleague, Dr. Anant Shenoy.
Thank you so much for having me on. I used to be with the Virginia Mason team as a member of the core faculty, and now I work at another local institution, and I get to work with the wonderful residents at WSU and some of the medical students at the WSU Everett campus. And I'm very excited to be on, and we're going to be talking about non-migraineous headaches today.
All right. Dr. Shenoy, if you could maybe give us a little bit of introduction, and then we'll jump into some cases.
Absolutely. So when dealing with headaches, we talk a lot about migraine headaches appropriately because they are the most common type of disabling headache. But today we're going to focus on the non-migraineous headaches, of which the most common is tension type headaches. And these are very, very common. Migraines are more common in terms of patients who come in seeking medical care, but overall tension type headaches are probably the most common type of headache that humans in general experience. And the first point of a headache workup, and this sounds particularly ironic given that we're talking about non-migraineous headaches, is ruling out migraines as one of the causes of the headache that you're working up, as well as then also thinking about ruling out other secondary causes of kind of life-altering, really severe etiologies driving a headache. Dr. Song, who helped put together this didactic, reminds us to think about their different mnemonics for remembering the really bad secondary causes of headaches. And there's one called SNOOP-10, which we'll review very briefly, but I direct the listener to look at the reader to see this in more detail. Other key points when thinking about headaches, even though the most common ones are tension and migraine, which tend to be benign, that you really want to do a good neurologic exam, in particular looking for papilledema via our fundoscopic exam, which, as Dr. Song points out, the more you do, the better you get at it, which is so true. And when you have the luxury of time in residency clinic, if indeed you do have that, I encourage everyone to get out that ophthalmoscope and look at everyone's eyes, regardless of whether or not they have a headache. Now, as I mentioned before, a key headache tidbit in any headache workup is thinking about migraines and either ruling it in or ruling it out, because it's the most common cause of headache that leads to someone coming into the clinic. There's the pound mnemonic, which is, I'll just be really brief, pulsatile, 4 to 72 hours, unilateral, causing nausea, and disabling. And if you have four or more of those five features, the likelihood ratio for migraine is 24. That is an absurdly high likelihood ratio. If you only have three of those five characteristics, it's still a likelihood ratio of 3.5, which is still a pretty good likelihood ratio to increase your pretest probability. So basically, if you have those features, you should be thinking migraine. Some other really helpful points going in. Other very common headache is medication overuse headache. And you should be thinking about this whenever they have 10 or more days of headache a month. Odds are it's medication overuse. Also, another related thing to think about, when do we need brain imaging? I can't tell you how often people are worried about if they have brain cancer. I'm sure you also. Yeah, Dr. Mohan is nodding very vigorously. Basically, if you suspect a secondary cause, or if they're having cluster headaches or any abnormality on neurologic exam, you want to be getting head imaging. And if there's concern for an active bleed, you need urgent head imaging, i.e. it's time to get to the ER for a non-contrast CT. That said, if you need brain imaging and it's not acute and you're not worried about a stroke or an ongoing bleed, you want to get an MRI with and without contrast. That's very important. All the time, I see that a CT head is done, non-con, and the assumption is that's enough. That is not enough. You need an MRI with and without contrast. Other kind of related key tidbits about headaches in general. Cluster headaches, they are short, less than 3 hours, whereas migraines generally are longer, several hours. And then kind of the scary hemicrania syndromes, which if you don't know what they are, you're like, oh my goodness, is this person having a TIA or stroke? But hemicrania continua, it's part of the spectrum of trigeminal autonomic cephalalgias, which are TACs. And there are a couple of different ones, and part of their diagnostic criteria is they literally respond to indomethacin, our good old indomethacin that we also use with gout. Another point, I'm going to shift my focus a little bit. We have our health equity spotlight. When we think about disparities in healthcare, Dr. Song found a really helpful one, that the prevalence of severe headaches and migraines among different ethnic and racial groups is actually, it's quite similar as far as how often they are likely to have. However, Black patients and patients of Hispanic ethnicity are 25 and 50% less likely to receive a migraine diagnosis even when they have a migraine. So that is something that literally us as clinicians are responsible for. Also, Black patients who presented the ED with a headache are 5 times less likely than white patients to receive a CAT scan. So less likely to get appropriate imaging and workup for serious causes. And then those with lower socioeconomic status tend to have higher migraine rates and less likely to receive acute treatment. So basically, when we think about this, it looks like race is a factor that influences healthcare decision making, and all of us have a role of combating that, as does lower socioeconomic status, insurance status, and then geographical disparities. All of these contribute to inequities that all of us can do something about. So anyways, I really appreciate Dr. Song making that call out and a reminder and a call to action for all of us.
Thank you for sharing that. So we're going to go ahead. We're going to switch over to doing some cases. So your first patient is a 35-year-old woman with a history of depression, elevated BMI at 32, high cholesterol, prediabetes, and comes in for 6 months of headache. She has had dull bilateral headaches up to 4 times a week, for which she has been taking ibuprofen and acetaminophen for the past 3 months with some benefit. She works as an in-home aide and has had to miss work several times in the past month due to headache. No associated nausea, vomiting, photophobia, or phonophobia. She is concerned about how her headaches are impacting her ability to work and care for her young kids at home. You perform a very complete neurologic exam, as you have requested us to do, and find no focal deficits, including her fundoscopic exam, which is normal without evidence of papilledema. So what are the primary and the secondary headache disorders, and how do you distinguish them from each other?
All right. So, and I will say this is a very suggestive history already, but let's take a step back. So thinking about primary and secondary headaches. So headaches are very common in general. The lifetime prevalence is greater than 2/3 of all people. And again, I'm very shocked when I meet someone who has never had a headache in their life. That is just mind-boggling to me as someone who suffers from several different types of headaches. And generally speaking, most headaches are primary headaches and kind of the big three categories. We have migraines, which has somewhere around a 12% lifetime prevalence, tension type headaches, which are at least close to 40% lifetime prevalence. And the third major category are those TACs, those trigeminal autonomic headaches. The classic example is a cluster headache, but that is not the only type of this headache. And these have a much, much lower lifetime prevalence, less than 1%. The estimate is somewhere around 0.1%. It's like 1 in 1,000. Now, those are primary headache disorders. We also have secondary headaches, and these are usually due to something else, hence secondary. So we have things like trauma to the head or trauma to the neck that can trigger headaches. There are vascular causes like temporal arteritis or like a intracranial hemorrhage. Then other intracranial processes like a mass lesion or elevated intracranial pressure or inflammatory cause. Then we have medication overuse, which is a very common secondary form of headache. Then withdrawal like from things like opiates or side effects to things like all the drugs we prescribe. Then you have intracranial infections like meningitis. Then there are disorders of homeostasis like those high altitude induced ones or diving, obstructive sleep apnea, hypertension, like severe untreated hypertension. Then you can think of in terms of ENT causes like sinusitis or TMJ dysfunction. There are psychiatric or behavioral health causes like somaticization or psychosis. And then cranial neuropathies, again, related to things like trigeminal neuralgia, which is different than the trigeminal autonomic cephalalgias, which are their own type of primary headache. Dr. Song recommends using the Snoop-10 mnemonic, which I'm not going to go through in detail. I would direct the listener to check out the reader. It can be very helpful for evaluating risk factors for secondary headaches because these are a bunch of red flags, things like that papilledema that you very astutely looked for.
Yes, and you can also find that mnemonic probably also on UpToDate as well if you don't happen to have the didactic nearby and handy. So what type of primary headache do you think this patient has and what treatment do you recommend?
Yes. So really good question. I'm actually thinking of two types of headaches, one a primary, one a secondary. But I have a strong suspicion here for a tension type headache. Just a reminder, these tend to be bilateral. The severity is mild to moderate. They're usually not severe. And generally speaking, they're not made worse with physical activity. They often feel like a squeezing or a pressure-like band, hence the tension type in it. And it can be associated with pain or muscular tenderness in the head and neck and shoulder region. Now, in this patient, we're missing kind of the classic migraine features, like the pulsatile throbbing character, the nausea or vomiting, the exacerbation with physical activity, and the phono or photophobia. Now, that said, you actually can sometimes see photophobia and phonophobia in tension-type headaches, but generally not both phono and photophobia at the same time. So again, we don't have the migraineous features. We do have things that fit better with a tension-type headache in this case. Just as a short aside, how do we treat tension-type headaches? Well, generally, over-the-counter analgesics like acetaminophen and non-steroidals. You can try caffeine for acute treatment. And generally, the triptans, which tend to be mainstays of migraine, are not helpful for tension type because of the different etiologies of those two headaches. If you have someone who keeps getting tension type headaches very frequently and they can't change the provoking features that are probably driving it, there are pharmacologic preventative classes. So tricyclic antidepressants have been looked at, as has mirtazapine and venlafaxine. Also, interestingly, CBT can be helpful, presumably by helping working on the muscle tension that drives it, then mindfulness, and even acupuncture has a role in tension type treatment prevention. Now, the other type of headache I would be thinking about here is a secondary headache, medication overuse. And a really key thing to know about medication overuse, generally some other headache type started the headaches, and then the patient was using the analgesics to treat it and then caused another type of headache, the medication overuse headache, which tends to then become the dominant headache type that they are dealing with. Medication overuse headaches are miserable, usually defines at least 10 days a month, if not 15 headache days a month. And they're using acute analgesics for that for months at a time, at least 3 months. And any type of headache relieving medication can cause it. That's really key. So acetaminophen can do it. Nonsteroidals can do it. Opiates can do it. Triptans can do it. Barbiturates can do it, which generally we're not using very often anymore, but still. And ergotamines. So like the triptans and the ergotamines, which we classically use to treat migraines, can cause medication overuse. And even a combination of all analgesics. So someone who's rotating acetaminophen and nonsteroidals still can get medication overuse. Basically, if they're having 15 or more headache days a month with over-the-counters or 10 or more days a month with prescription analgesics of any category for headaches, you should be thinking about medication overuse headache. How do you treat those? Well, Dr. Mohan, this is very, very challenging. You have to basically get rid of the analgesics. And it's not switch one analgesic for another. So if like acetaminophen is causing it, they can't just go to ibuprofen. That doesn't address the issue. They have to come off all of them. So what do you do? Well, you do a lot of education. You work with them to get them to the point they're in agreement. And then you probably look at putting them on a preventative while you come off the acute analgesics. Very, very challenging.
Definitely something that we see a lot of in clinic. So it is good to get very comfortable with having that chat of some of those headaches are being done to themselves, and also be ready to talk about preventative medications. And I'll often say like, hey, we can do these for maybe 3 months, and then we can talk about trying to come off or wean off. But at the very least, this will keep you from doing medications that are going to just make you keep having headaches. All right, so we're going to switch cases. And now you're going to have a 40-year-old man with current smoking and history of MVA here to establish care. He has had severe right-sided headaches associated with right-sided rhinorrhea. He has had several headaches like this over the past week, most of them occurring at night. Each headache episode lasts about an hour and then spontaneously resolves. He's concerned he might have a brain tumor and appears anxious. His HENT and neurologic exams are normal, including his fundoscopic exam. What type of headache disorder do you suspect? Would you recommend additional workup?
So these are not common, but they're, I'll say, very gratifying when you make the diagnosis and treat them. So I would be very suspicious here of a trigeminal autonomic cephalalgia syndrome. This sounds very much like a cluster headache. There are other syndromes in this family, including paroxysmal hemicrania, and then short-lasting unilateral neuralgiform headache, which is SUNA. There's hemicrania continua. Basically, there's a subset of disorders, and they're not common. They're maybe 1 in 1,000, and of which cluster headaches, which this is what this sounds like that this patient has, is the most common of this subset of trigeminal autonomic cephalalgias. And just to call it out, this is not trigeminal neuralgia, which is a different syndrome that can cause a secondary headache. Now, this class, trigeminal autonomic cephalalgias, they're unilateral. They typically will feel in the periorbital or temporal space, and they are severe. These are really bad headaches. And they are associated, very importantly, with ipsilateral autonomic symptoms, usually in the V1 branch of the trigeminal nerve. Again, not trigeminal neuralgia. And so you can get lacrimation, conjunctival injection, you can get ptosis or meiosis, you can get nasal congestion or rhinorrhea, and facial flushing. Also, they often feel quite restless and they're in distress. So this is like the classic for these. You get autonomic plus a unilateral headache. Now, of these syndromes, cluster headache, most common in men, like a 3-to-1 ratio, and typically adults in the 20 to 40 age range. And in fact, just anecdotally, all my patients with cluster headaches have been in this group. And there might be a tobacco association, although it's not the strongest. These headaches are spontaneous. They are severe. They usually occur later in the day, and they're short, 15 minutes to 3 hours, which if you're experiencing one does not feel short, but nonetheless, it's much shorter than migraines, which tend to be 4 hours or longer. And generally, when you get hit with a cluster headache, as the name would suggest, they come in clusters. So generally, you will get them boom, 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 day after day, usually every other day to every day. Sometimes you can get several a day, up to 8 a day. And the clusters can go from weeks to months, and then generally they spontaneously go away for a while, but can come back months to years later. Some of the other syndromes like paroxysmal hemicrania or short-lasting unilateral neuralgia form headache with conjunctival injection and tearing. These can be triggered by sensory stimuli, like certain types of light or flashing or smells can trigger these. And in contrast to cluster headaches, the other types of these TACs are usually identified that they tend to respond well to indomethacin, good old indomethacin. And these sometimes can be hard to tease out from trigeminal neuralgia just because of the way that they feel, like that intensity of pain and the distribution. But as a good reminder to us, trigeminal neuralgia tends to prefer V2 and V3 branches rather than V1, which the TACs like V1. Another one of these syndromes is hemicrania continua, which also has those autonomic features, but the pain can be really severe and could go on for a long time. For anyone who's cared for hemicrania continua, it sucks. It'll go on for months, but it tends to also respond to indomethacin, hence it's part of the diagnostic criteria. Now, this patient is very worried, as you said, that they might have a brain tumor. And in fact, when you have a patient who's coming in with a cluster headache or another one of these trigeminal autonomic cephalgias, you should actually get an MRI brain. Even though it's a primary headache type, you want to get the MRI brain with and without contrast because you are looking for a lesion in the posterior fossa or the pituitary or the cavernosus sinus, which can trigger this type of headache. So basically, they're intense headaches. It is appropriate to get brain imaging. And you want to get, as a reminder, if you're looking for a headache, you get an MRI with and without.
Perfect. And for anybody who is trying to mentally revise what is V1, V2, V3, and how it looks like, just keep in mind V1, think of those Roman legion helmets that have like a nose piece. That should cover your V1. V2 is most of your face otherwise. And V3, think of the person's mandible jawline. So let's think about what acute and preventative treatments could you offer for this patient?
Yeah, so unfortunately, the TACs are fairly miserable. They cause a lot of distress. Cluster headaches, which is what we strongly suspect this patient has, these do tend to respond to triptans. And because of how intense and short-acting these headaches are, you want the quick-absorbing ones, like the subcutaneous injection or the intranasal triptans, which you generally inject, the intranasal you want to spray into the contralateral nostril because, again, the ipsilateral one is usually congested and it's not going to work as well. You tend to get a good response. Up to 80% of patients will respond. And again, the goal is to treat the acute headache. And generally speaking, eventually these are going to go away. Although we'll talk about prevention in a moment. The other acute treatment is oxygen via non-rebreather mask, which you're running basically high flow O2 at 10 to 15 liters a minute. You're basically getting close to like 90 to 95% FiO2. You can't usually get these at home. These are hard to get covered. The time that I've done this in clinic, I've literally had the patient come into clinic as soon as they can get in and I'll give it to them in clinic. This is cumbersome logistically. This is a pain in the neck. Try the triptans. Now, if someone is having these miserable cluster headaches and they're not abating and they're like, look like they're going to go on for weeks to months, think about prevention. First line drug is verapamil, that calcium channel blocker. You can also use high dose steroids because again, people are miserable. And then there's a CGRP monoclonal antibody that's FDA approved, very expensive. And your refractory option is a greater occipital nerve block through physiology. I don't quite understand about how that works.
What if he had a history of coronary artery disease?
Such a good internal medicine question, Dr. Mohan. So as a reminder, triptans can cause coronary artery vasoconstriction. And so the FDA appropriately recommends avoiding triptans in any patient with a history of coronary disease or stroke or TIA. Now the data here is actually kind of mixed. Dr. Song very nicely has kind of given us a nice summation, but basically this has been looked at in a couple of different kind of trials. There's a case crossover study where basically the patient themselves was acting as their own control, but they'd go through treatment and then they would come off of it. And when you look at cardiovascular events, the both pre-triptan and post-triptan, there's odds ratio of about 3 for myocardial infarction and stroke for those right after using a triptan. I know it's very convoluted the way I said it, but basically it happened infrequently in this crossover study, but this is one of the main bases for saying we shouldn't use triptans in those who were concerned to have a high risk for coronary disease or stroke. So in this case, if we feel like a triptan is contraindicated, another nice option for both cluster headaches as well as for migraines, although that's not the point of this didactic, is those transcutaneous vagus nerve stimulation devices, of which there's several different ones on the market. And that is probably a talk for another time.
Yes, highly recommend everybody tune into the migraine didactic that was done with Dr. Erica Cunningham, who is both a professional and personal expert in migraines, who shares a lot of her personal experiences with using various of these devices. All right, so new patient, 65-year-old man with history of hypertension, high cholesterol, diabetes, and CAD, status post drug-eluting stent 3 months ago on dual antiplatelet therapy. Oh goodness. Comes in with a chief concern of headache. He has had several weeks of diffuse headache and lightheadedness. His wife accompanies him to the visit and notes that he's been more forgetful during this time and adds that he had an unwitnessed fall several weeks ago while getting out of bed. No nausea, vomiting, or vision changes. Afebrile, blood pressure is 150/76. head, neck, neurologic exams, all normal. So what additional workup would you recommend and what are you looking for? Are there any things that are making you feel a little concerned?
Oof. No, Dr. Mohan, I feel great. This patient, however, I'm highly concerned for. Oh, goodness. Okay, so we did mention the Snoop 10 mnemonic for those clinical features that really should scream red flag, worry about a severe secondary cause. So here we have several of them. We have an older patient, we have trauma with a fall, and they're on antiplatelet therapy, which again can increase your risk for bleeding, obviously. In this case, I am highly concerned for an intracranial hemorrhage. Like, we literally have trauma in the setting of antiplatelet therapy with a change in symptoms since. In this case, we need to image the brain. This is a situation where a non-contrast head CT probably very, very helpful because again, we are worried for an intracranial hemorrhage. Now that said, if you're in the ER where they have an MRI, the MRI is gonna be a better scan. Basically, when it comes to bleeding in the brain, if it's an acute arterial bleed within the first couple hours, non-con CT is the best. Otherwise, any other type of bleed that's been longer, MRI, better scan. So in this case, ideally, if we can get it rapidly, an MRI with and without contrast is the preferred modality. But if you what you can get urgently is a non-con head CT, get that. I am very concerned about an intracranial hemorrhage, probably a venous bleed rather than arterial bleed because they'd already be dead if it was an arterial bleed. Yeah, so highly worried.
All right. And what are some factors that make headache diagnosis and management more challenging in older adults?
Ooh, and I'm guessing you're asking other than the fact that they are less likely to come in and tell you about it, which also makes it more
common. That too.
Yeah, that makes it more challenging. So secondary headaches tend to be more common as we get older. So one study looking at new onset headaches seen by neurologists, 15% of patients over the age of 65 had a secondary cause of headache. Whereas when you look at patients under the age of 65, it was only 1.6%. So pretty big difference. Basically, the older we are, the more likely there's a secondary cause, or it's a secondary headache rather. Specific considerations that you have to think about in older adults that are unlikely in younger adults, to think about things like temporal arteritis, which as we know, strong correlation with age, intracranial hemorrhage, of course, because those bridging veins are more fragile and frail, and they're more likely to be on drugs that will cause bleeding or increase bleeding. And then of course, neoplasms get more likely as we get older. Also, polypharmacy is more common. Hooray, we give people medications. So the non-headache medicines that can cause headaches, calcium channel blockers, like nifedipine, proton pump inhibitors, ooh, because we put everybody on those. SSRIs can also do it. And those are just common categories. Basically, every medication ever developed has a small chance of a headache. That has been my finding so far. That said, even though secondary headaches are more common in older adults, tension type and migraine are still the most common cause of headaches. In older adults and younger adults, basically across the board with adults, those are your two most common types. Now, what makes treatment more challenging in older adults is that triptans are more likely to be contraindicated because our patients are more likely to have coronary disease or strokes. NSAIDs have a higher risk, as we know, in our older adults because of GI bleeds, renal insufficiency, and of course, cardiac events. And then the other preventative class, tricyclics, of course, have anticholinergic effects and are on Beer's list and are also more likely to do things like arrhythmias and urinary retention and cognitive impairment. So it's harder to treat because the categories of drugs we use tend to cause more side effects in our older patients. So more likely to have serious etiologies and then harder to treat.
All right. Well, thank you for going through so many cases with us and I think giving us a good framework for thinking about our non-migraine primary headaches, as well as thinking about when we should be thinking about secondary headaches, how to evaluate them, and also how to deal with the ever frustrating medication overuse headache. So thank you so much for sharing your expertise and your time.
Thank you so much for having me, and I hope everybody has a wonderful week.
Bye, everyone.